The views discussed in this conversation are the views of individuals and not of Arrington Capital. This podcast is provided solely for informational purposes and is not financial, legal, tax, or investment advice. The participants of this podcast are not recommending any particular security, protocol, token, financial instrument, or other tradable asset or any investment strategy, and is not offering to sell or soliciting to buy any security or asset.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Pirate Pod from Arrington Capital. Today's episode is a conversation between Michael Arrington and Arthur Hayes. It covers macroeconomics, global monetary policy, investment trends, advice for founders, and more. The discussion begins with Arthur's take on where we're at during this cycle. If you assume we're in the final turning, as outlined in Neil Howe's book, The Fourth Turning is Here.
So I think that this cycle is the last cycle of this particular form of geopolitical arrangement that was, you know, probably made in the 1945, enhanced in 1971, a little bit more enhanced in 94 and 2000 with the rise of China. And now we're going to see a complete dissolution of this system and its shift to something new. And the question is, what is that new system? Nobody knows. So be long volatility, essentially be long Bitcoin. And that's kind of my overarching thesis of the macro world, and everything else kind of flows from that.
How bad do you think things will get for like regular people around the world while we're going through this situation?
Let's hope that the war this time is fought in cyberspace and not on, you know, physical Earth. Obviously, there are people in war-torn areas, like, you know, Ukrainians, Russians, Israelis, yeah, Palestinians, blah, 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 right? There's people who are suffering under war right now, but a general global configuration where you lose 5-10% of the global male population because people, old motherfuckers said they wanted to kill some people. Hopefully that isn't what happens. Maybe there's sort of cyber disruption, you know, machines fighting each other in space, something like that. But for the average person, it just means, okay, maybe if you're Chinese, you don't go to Europe or America. If you're American, you don't go to China or Russia, and your travel options are limited based on how the blocks develop. And that's the worst that it gets to. But we're definitely going to see some change in the way we, you know, move around the world over the next few years, I think.
One thing you talk about a lot in a lot of the guys, people, including Lynn Alden, so men and women that I read, like, talk a lot about fiscal dominance. I actually don't fully understand what fiscal dominance is. Can you explain what it means?
Basically, in most economies, the central bank is supposedly independent from the treasury. And the point is that you don't want the entity that can print money cashing the checks of the politicians. So the politicians, they want to spend money. They need to go to the electorate or go to the elites that they answer to and say, hey, we want to spend this money. We need to increase taxes in a certain way to pay for it. And that's sort of the check, because obviously people don't like their taxes going up. And so if you're going to spend more money, everyone better think it's worth it. Regardless of whether you're in a democracy or an autocratic system, there's a social contract of this much of my effort goes into the government, and the government provides me these services in return. Now, obviously, politicians around the world, regardless if they're elected or not, like to give out free shit to people and claim that it doesn't cost anything. And so what happens is, if they're able to raise debt to such a level, then the funding of the government, which is a job of some sort of Ministry of Finance or Treasury function, subsumes the central bank. And then central bank decision making ceases to become independent and is just a function of, how do I make sure that the government can spend money as they wish at an affordable rate? And we've seen this many times in the past. In an American context, 1945 or 42, whatever, to 51, when the Fed and the Treasury merged and yield curve control existed, and, you know, the 10-year Treasury was pinned at 2.5%. Yeah. And we've seen this in many other Argentinian contexts. You're seeing it now, obviously, starting in the U.S. It's practically happened in Japan. So that's fiscal dominance. It's, we cast aside this illusion that there is an independent central bank. And if you want to put it in the U.S. context, I'm imagining most of your viewers are from the United States. Janet Yellen becomes Jay Powell's boss, as opposed to them being colleagues on a horizontal level.
Yeah. You mean literally becomes? I mean, did in that period after World War II, did they literally, like,
yes, They literally pulled
the treasury and did what treasury said.
Exactly.
I didn't know that. Okay. So we're not there yet, at least officially, right? Also interesting.
On paper, yes, that's true. Unofficially, I would believe that Jay Powell already reports to Janet. Yeah. Maybe he doesn't know it yet, but Janet can do things that Jay can't, and her actions have way more says, and then Jay can't pursue his inflation fighting policies of either restricting the quantity of money or raising its price.
Yeah.
And we've already seen that starting to happen. Why is Jay Powell tapering purchase on a balance sheet that's $7 trillion that started at $2 trillion in 2008 in the face of inflation trending of his target? He should be continuing on his quest of reducing the quantity of money. If he wasn't under fiscal dominance, he should not be tapering the central bank purchases. So that already tells us that he de facto reports to Janet.
Okay, but whether he reports to Janet or not, his job supposedly is inflation control and unemployment. But what his job really seems to be is maintaining an orderly market in treasuries, right?
Correct.
And that seems to be the real problem for him, is maintaining that orderly market in treasuries.
That's Janet's problem, and his, and he basically has to put policies forward to help that happen on his end of the spectrum. Yeah.
So that means interest rates are definitely coming down. They have to, right? Even if you don't buy into the idea of fiscal dominance, although I think that's more of a mathematical thing, or that the Fed will report to Treasury, just simply you get to a point where, you know, we cannot afford, literally cannot afford to make the interest payments on the debt. It's already greater than defense now, right? Which is not a good
thing. There's two camps, right? There's somebody who believes that the quantity of money is more important. Some people believe the price is more important. I'm in the quantity of money camp, where I don't really care what the price is. I care how much credit money is in the system. And so I'm more focused on the level of bank reserves and how different central banks manage that versus what their policy rate is. I don't care if the policy rate goes up or down. There's more credit being created in various forms, at least in the US dollar context, than there was last month. And so that tells me that monetary conditions continue to be easy, and risky asset prices, crypto being the one that I care the most about, will continue to have a persistent bid under them, and any sort of weakness should be bought.
Yeah. I also noticed in your last essay, which I think was this month, unless you've written something sooner than May 2nd, you're kind of talking about get your portfolio in order and then sort of take the summer off. Right. And I don't know if you mean that, how literally you mean that, but like, are you actually getting to the point where you're not too worried about the short term up and downs? You're just like looking at the long term here and getting yourself in position?
Yeah. I mean, there's some core positions that I'm adding to that I like that are trading on weakness. And once I've done doing that, I probably won't do any trading for 2 to 3 months.
And until that means any trading. Like,
yeah.
Go have fun.
Yeah. Unless. Because I believe that crypto is a reaction to what's happening in sort of the TradFi monetary political world. So those motherfuckers are on vacation. I'm on vacation. Why are you trying to trade? It's just like you're just going to get chopped up. Volumes are going to be tepid. Volatility is low. It's going to be hard to discern where the trend is, especially if you're a day trader using leverage. This is a very dangerous time to be trading because you're going to fake yourself out on the long end, the short side, and eviscerate your capital, where you should be just putting it into things that you like. Maybe they go down another 10-20%. Who cares? You're really here for the shit show that's going to start in September and October when everybody gets back and starts making more bad decisions.
And the election.
Yeah, and the U.S. election and all the other elections around the world.
Yeah. So you think things are going to get really crazy in Q4?
Yes.
How crazy?
You know, maybe the U.S. and Russia decide to commit forces. Maybe U.S. Biden decides he needs to send some bombs over Iran to prove that he's a war hawk. Who knows, right? Something like that could happen. Maybe Macron decides that he needs to send some troops, and then Russia kicks their ass, and then NATO needs to get involved in Russia. Who knows, right? All these things could happen. We don't know. But again, they're all on vacation. They get back. They get back to making bad decisions again.
How much do you worry about energy costs? You mentioned something over Iran. Like, does that factor in too much? I know you care about money supply. You care less about interest rates. Where do energy costs come in? Also, the fact that gold in particular is completely decoupled from the interest rate environment, you know, since we took Russia's reserves, like, it seems like gold goes up even though interest rates have gone up. how does energy play into all this? Do you care at all about that?
Oh, absolutely care about the price of energy. That is just another factor that crimps the response of policymakers, right? Because they can't control inflation. They can control a lot of things. But if the oil price goes to $200 a barrel, then every energy importers, Japan, the weak yen becomes an acute issue. Anyone who needs to sell oil now has more money and they can do things that maybe other people wouldn't like them to do, right? Russia's budget surplus will go up. Some of these other countries will have more money to continue fighting in the face of probably even more intense opposition. So, yes, the price of energy matters. Can't really predict where it goes. I'm big in the nuclear game. There's also the AI narrative starting to go spin there. Very so
energy-intensive. Yeah,
I think it's definitely because people believe in the green bullshit economics. And so they haven't invested in oil and gas. You know, the U.S., which is what, the number two or number three largest commodity oil and gas exporter, doesn't drill anymore.
Yeah.
That's probably going to change, regardless of which party wins the election. So I think the energy market's super important. People have been ignoring it because they've been lulled into this complacency that it doesn't matter, that we're just going to let the sun shine and the wind blow, and that's going to give us all the energy we need. But that's patently false. So definitely an underinvested area. And if crypto gets to such an insane valuation versus base energy productive companies, then it's probably a situation where you should be selling some of your crypto and buying ExxonMobil or Cameco or some of these other companies.
You mentioned Japan in that, and they're somewhere. And, you know, Japan needs to import a lot of energy. And because the yen is so weak, they need to basically sell treasuries right now to pay for it. What happened last week? I actually am not sure what happened. We gave Japan some kind of line of credit or just cash to encourage them not to sell their T-bills. Like, what do you know what happened?
So I'm actually writing my third draft of an essay about this. And
okay,
so essentially, and this is not my view, this is me reading a lot of Russell Napier. I talk to David Dredge at Convex Asia quite frequently in Singapore. Luke Roman also writes a bit about this as well. And so, you know, a friend of mine, and I'm also a client, David Dredge, has an interesting quote, and it's, "Japan lights the match, China provides the accelerant, and the war is fought in Europe." And basically, essentially what he means by that is that the value of the Japanese yen is the most important variable globally. So if you do anything else in the world, the only thing you need to look at is, where's the yen? Is it weak or is it strong? And the situation is that China and Japan have pursued the same economic policy since they came out of World War II, which is, we're going to export stuff to the U.S. and we're going to, you know, run a mercantilist policy to have a net exporting economy, which means that they have accumulated a lot of savings. They've reinvested those savings in the U.S. treasuries. So Japan's the number one holder of U.S. treasuries. China's number two. But they directly compete with each other in the growing export market, which is the global south or the emerging markets. So I was just looking at a cool chart that Gavkal Research published, and it tracks auto imports into emerging markets across Germany, U.S., Japan, and China. China has now surged into number one spot, followed closely behind by Japan. And if you've taken a look at the yen over the past sort of like 3 or 4 years, it's weakened dramatically. But the PBOC, the People's Bank of China, has kept the yuan relatively stable versus the U.S. dollar.
Yeah.
And what they care about is not the value of yuan in dollars. They care about how competitive are they versus the Japanese. And so if the yen keeps weakening, China has to respond by devaluing the CNY. And the way they manage the pace of that devaluation is by selling treasuries, which is obviously not good for Yellen and Powell because they need to maintain the orderly market. So if your number two largest holder is selling, everyone else is going to sell too. And then you get sort of a, you know, UK gilts 30-year style market dislocation event. And then the central bank has to, you know, pivot for real, introduce yield curve control, and that's basically game over. So that's what they're all trying to avoid. A weak yen yields to Chinese response. The yen can't strengthen because the BOJ and Japan Inc. runs a massive carry trade. The largest holder of GOT bonds in Japan is the BOJ. They also decide whether to raise rates. if they raise rates to reduce the interest rate differential, which causes the yen weakness between the dollar, then the BOJ stands to lose the most amount of money of any institution and probably lose all credibility because they'll be, you know, very functionally insolvent. So they don't want to raise rates. They haven't done it yet. They keep basically trying to hint that they're not going to do it, but the yen keeps weakening. And so my theory, and sort of this is coming from, you know, Napier more so than others, is that, as you mentioned, there's this thing called the US dollar swap line. And I think as of yesterday, the day before, the Bank of Japan has like a $1 million, some token amount of a swap. And for listeners, that means the Bank of Japan borrows dollars, the Fed borrows yen, and they swap at a rate. Cool. So obviously, each central bank can print the unlimited amount of their own currency. So if the Bank of Japan needs to hand over dollars to the Ministry of Finance to intervene into the markets, meaning manipulate the value of the yen stronger, then the Fed could issue them unlimited amounts of dollars to go in the FX markets and do that. That's a great way for the BOJ to avoid raising rates and avoid selling any sort of bonds.
Yeah.
And it increases dollar liquidity. It weakens the dollar, which is the goal of Yellen. So that helps the US manufacturing. That helps the Chinese because now they can weaken their currency alongside the US by issuing more credit domestically to help fund their manufacturing machine. So it's a win-win for all three parties. It's a win for crypto because now you've basically added an unlimited spigot of dollar liquidity, which will push up asset prices globally. The risk is that essentially the US monetary officials are taking on yen, which essentially are Japanese government bonds, at wildly high prices because the yields are, you know, 1% versus a 4% inflation rate in Japan. And so at some point, if ever the policymakers decide to get off this train, the losses will be catastrophic because the yen isn't worth that. GDBs are not worth what they're paying for them.
And the Fed will take that loss from their balance.
The Fed will take that loss. And then you get the same situation that they forestalled, which is selling of treasuries, yield curve control. Yeah. So it all ends in the same place. How do we get there? I think the easiest way for them is to allow a massive limited dollar swap line with the BOJ. They're testing it now. And so this is what all I'm going to be watching is the dollar yen exchange rate. And every night, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York publishes the swap counterparties, the tenor, the weight, and the amount. And we can see it in real time, see if they take the easy way out. But the hard way is also lead to the same place. It's just, you know, a little bit more chaotic.
All right, quick question. So interestingly, you know, we are a hedge fund. We're both a venture fund. We invest in new startups, and then we have a liquid fund. The guy that runs our liquid fund, as you know, is Bhavik Patel, who used to be your chief product officer at BitMEX.
Yes.
The reason I say all that, one, it's just cool. He's a great guy, and you hired very well there. But two, like, I don't know half of the words you just said. Like, I'm interested in this stuff, but I mostly rely on Bhavik, who used to work for you, to understand it all. What's a dollar swap? What did you say? Blind? I don't know what that is.
Dollar swap line. So basically, for all friendly.
You say line banks, or blind?
It was just line. L-I-N-E, oh, line.
Got it. Yeah. So that's just where we send them dollars that are freshly printed and they send us. That's it. Correct.
That's all it is. Very simple. Yeah.
And it's an actual trade. It's not like a credit line that's expected to be paid back, or they do pay back.
There's a term, right? The swap expires at a certain point, and then there's an interest rate differential, right? It has to reflect the domestic interest rates, and then they swap it back.
Okay. All right. Okay. I kind of got that. In all this, you haven't mentioned interest rates really at all. I mean, a little bit there. But the point is that you really don't care that much about whatever the interest rates are on
Treasury. I care to the extent that the BOJ has the easiest monetary policy of the major central banks.
Yeah.
The Fed has the tightest in a relative perspective, which means that, you know, if Fed funds is 5.5 and yen deposit rates are 10 basis points – okay, even if the BOJ raises 100 basis points or the Fed cuts 100 basis points, I still am selling yen versus dollars because the interest rate differential is so large. So, and the Fed isn't going to cut from 5.5 to zero for domestic political reasons, and the BOJ isn't going to raise from 0.1 to 5.5 because it'll go bankrupt. So either side can move. The differential stays. There has to be another way to square the circle.
Yeah. So, if you became dictator of the U.S. right now, not the world, just the U.S., you could do whatever you want. You want, and you were, your goals were to make life best for the most amount of people in the U.S. What would you do? There really isn't a way out of this, is there?
Of course. bankrupt the banks. Just destroy, devalue the dollar against gold. See where the chips fall.
Okay, any so bank that goes, Okay. So
whichever banks or financial institutions go bust, hand it over to the depositors and let them run the institution. Like what should have happened in 2008. Like there's a whole bankruptcy law. It's been, you know, adjudicated for hundreds of years.
Which in 2008 and didn't and wasn't allowed.
And
yeah.
It's very painful as people in Argentina are finding out. Like this is not a, oh yeah, there's just this easy solution. And if they just did that, then all of a sudden the good times are here. No, this is, you know, possible Great Depression style pain. But out of that, once you cleanse the system, then your balance sheet is a much better place to move forward.
Yeah. So what happens if you, do you let the banks fail because interest rates rise very quickly and that screws up their bond portfolio? How are the banks failing in this scenario?
You remove sort of this implicit government guarantee. You remove
insurance, FDIC insurance.
Yeah. FDIC insurance. Like there's after the, I think I wrote about this.
The weak banks or all banks. Yeah.
Yeah. And they can go into gold, you know, allow people to invest in Bitcoin and other currencies. Don't demonize them.
It's that simple. You remove the insurance, which isn't even, I mean, it's only, what is it, $250,000? But you remove that, everybody gets out of the weak banks because they also know the larger depositors have known they've been protected so far as well. So people are feel fairly safe being in whatever bank. But you do what you talk about. People get out of all the banks or most of them. And then
the chips fall where they may.
Yeah. Is there any politically acceptable? That can't happen, right?
No, that's the point. Who's the person who said it? I think it's Juncker, who used to be the head of the EU. He said, we all know what to do. We just don't know how to get reelected after we do it. So this is not difficult things to think about. This is what, you know, it's happening in Argentina. If you remember, I think it was, I forgot what year it was, but the former U.S. Treasury Secretary Andrew Mellon, his response to the Great Depression was liquidate labor, liquidate credit. And but obviously that wasn't very popular and he wasn't, he didn't last very long in that position. Yeah. So politicians, whether elected or not, do not like to take the hard option until they have no other option. So we're not at that point yet.
But what's going to happen is the money supply is
going
to dramatically. Yeah, the same thing, just a different way to get there.
Correct.
And it's going to come through massive inflation, and it has to come, right?
Unless we discover, you know,
some massive
cool fusion and like productivity goes to the roof and whatever, right? Cool. All right.
Yeah. Or like alien technologies here ready to go. We just don't know about it. That seems unlikely, or at least very unlikely at this point. So it's going to be bad. The media doesn't talk about this at all. The media hasn't been screaming to like get spending under control or any of that. At some point, they have to. Maybe if Trump is elected, then they start screaming. If Biden's reelected, at some point, the media has to start talking to people because politicians are often seem to be boxed in by what the media allow them to talk about. It's just going to
I don't think that. I don't think Trump's very boxed in by the media. He does what the fuck he wants, right? So he's going to spend more money than Biden, at least on paper. And people love free shit. No, there's no candidate who's campaigning saying, yes, I want to crash the economy by 30% so that we can right size our spending and get on no one's campaigning on that. So I don't see, it doesn't matter who wins, Trump, Biden.
And at this point, cutting spending doesn't really matter at our budget level, does it?
Well, I mean, to be a start, people will start believing in that they were serious and maybe stop buying Bitcoin or gold or some of these other things. But I don't see, you know, the U.S. is trying to maintain its hegemonic status. I don't see that the U.S. is going to reduce defense spending. The boomers are still a very large voting bloc and very engaged. Are they going to vote themselves out of healthcare benefits? I mean, they voted us all in their fucking houses during COVID lockdown. So I don't think that's going to happen either.
I mean, look, a lot of the people that you like in the research that you pay for, like we have the same research and we read it and it's getting bleaker and bleaker. And yet when you look at the news, real world, people just don't really talk about this stuff. And I think people who do know about it because they're reading the stuff that you and I read, you still don't know when to time it. That's the real question, right? It sounds like, you know, back to you're kind of timing it now and then you're going to forget about it to some extent is interesting. You know, we're thinking about that now. When do we time?
Well, I guess if I have it overall, I mean, I'm long a lot of stuff. I've been long a lot of stuff for a long time. I'm just trading around the margin, just having some fun, like just trying to predict things. Like,
yeah.
For if you don't want to get involved in timing, is buy Bitcoin, buy gold, buy an amount that you don't care what the value is. It's a call option. I mean, a put option on the global system, and then you just wait. And time and compounding interest are very powerful forces, and they will bring to heel this current situation. They've brought to heel every other profligate empire ever. They've all gone down the same way. This one will go down the same way too. You just have to wait.
You still like gold?
I love gold.
You own gold.
I like gold. I like gold because gold, I want to own the asset that is most likely to be depreciated against fiat currencies at a central bank level, which is every central bank has gold. They're buying more of it. And so there will be devaluation against gold. It's the only currency that every nation agrees, is real. Now, obviously, as crypto people, we think Bitcoin should be in the mix and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. But if you think about it from a TradFi perspective, those in charge believe in gold. If they didn't, then hand it to me. Fed doesn't believe in gold? Cool. Open up Fort Knox. Tell everyone American, every taxpayer, hey, come to Fort Knox and you can each have a gold bar. If they don't think it's valuable, they know it's fucking valuable. It's guarded by, however many armed guards will shoot to kill if you try to take it. So anyone who tries to claim that gold is not valuable is a fucking horse shitter. So it's valuable. They know it's valuable. They're all accumulating it. I should accumulate some too, because I know what the end game is. It's devaluation versus gold, which has happened every single other time when you've printed too much fiat money in history.
If you could only go own all of your assets, you could only own Bitcoin or physical gold that you have to deal with how to store it, what would your breakdown be in the percentages? 90-10 Bitcoin to gold?
I don't know. I have a very small percentage of gold versus how much Bitcoin I have.
Single digit or bigger.
Yeah. Or smaller than that, maybe.
And that's where you want it.
Yeah. I mean, of course, both could go to zero and I'll be fine economically. That's the point, right? Don't try to be so obstinate in the thing you choose. It's just that the Bitcoin's just gone out way more than the gold. So
yeah,
it's a bigger percentage.
But one of the things you talk about is the usefulness of Bitcoin isn't necessarily for everyday transactions. It's a way to move money between spheres, and you talk about the U.S. and the China, it might be hard to sort of move capital between them at some point. It's already hard. Bitcoin solves that problem. Gold doesn't. I mean, you have to put gold on an airplane to solve the same problem, right?
Yeah. Gold is a local hedge. It's like, hey, electricity's out. You got to get on the boat to go sail to the paradise land. Boatman doesn't take Bitcoin. Boatman takes gold. So, because boatman doesn't have a smartphone. So that's why I own gold.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, Athena is interesting. How concerned are you that it becomes another Luna?
It's a completely different. Athena and Luna will fail for different reasons. And so I think I'm sure you obviously know this, but for listeners who think that they're equivalent, they probably didn't read the Luna white paper the first time, and that's why they lost all their money. So the demise of Luna was written about at the second that it launched. It's an algorithmic stable coin. It's called the death spiral. There's been academic papers on this. I remember when I like looked up from my screen one day, I was like, oh, what's this Luna thing? I had my analyst go and research it. And literally one of the risk factors was the death spiral. And there's a fucking PDF. And I read it okay, this is how it's going to fail. Did I buy it anyways? Absolutely. Cause it was on a number go up sort of situation. I made some money. I got out of it. And as soon as the peg started to crack, when was it? Summer of 2022, I knew
it was May.
I was up. Game over. Yeah. This is going to zero because this is how it fails. Now, obviously, those who didn't read that or didn't choose to understand what they were doing were blindsided. Oh, how has this happened? I can't believe that this went from $40 billion to zero in 2 trading days. Well, sure read some shit. So I think that's Athena will not fail because of an ever-increasing amount of the collateral that backs it, because that's how Luna failed, because they just issued Luna Infinity to try to keep the peg at one. Athena will fail if the centralized exchanges and counterparties, the third-party custodians like Copper and some of these others, lose their Bitcoin. Yeah. Or the derivative trades are not paid out correctly if they're in profit. That's how they lose the peg. And so it is not zero risk. It is a different risk. And so depending on the risk that you want to take, Athena may or may not be suitable for you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's some things to talk about there, but honestly, a lot of this has been talked about, including by you in the past. On Luna, they were trying to transition to Bitcoin-backed, right? I mean, they were trying to build up Bitcoin reserves. They just
Yes, they were selling Luna that they had because it had a very high price and buying Bitcoin as a way to sort of like try to de-risk it.
I mean, look, that was a painful period for all of us because even people who weren't directly involved in Luna ended up getting crushed just because of the general market downturn that it started. So with Athena, besides, I think what you're describing is counterparty risk. What else can go wrong with it?
Well, the smart contract can fuck up. Maybe they didn't code something correctly. They mint an infinite amount of USDE, and that's then traded around DeFi and depressing prices and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, that's another risk. They their hedging algorithm doesn't work when they're minting and redeeming. They could fuck up that way.
But whereas Luna is mathematically unsound, you could say that even before it launched or when it launched. Athena, you think, is mathematically sound. And so the problems with it are going to happen from the things you just mentioned. Counterparty risk, broken contracts, bad algorithms. Like algorithms that fail to execute properly, not bad algorithms. Yeah. So you're pretty confident about it.
I'm confident that I understand the risk that they're taking, and I am confident that I like that risk.
Yeah. Okay. I don't disagree with you. Just it's good to have this because in 5 years, if something does blow up spectacularly, this would be a great sound clip, I guess. But it'll be, again, probably because one of the reasons you said so.
Yeah. Hopefully it doesn't.
Listen, mean that in the meanwhile.
I know.
The shitcoins. God, I can't believe I even just said that. Although you love your shitcoins.
I do.
Yeah. Why not just go into Bitcoin right now and just hold? Why even dabble? Is that just because
I can make more Bitcoin?
Yeah. But one thing that isn't clear to me, I mean, look, if Bitcoin goes up massively because of some of the things we talked about earlier, we know what's going to happen to the altcoins because we've seen it, you know, over and over again. But if it's a little bit bumpier of a road, you know, it could end up badly. It could end up poorly for you versus just holding Bitcoin. You know, one of the things we pay a lot of attention to isn't just volatility of these coins, but it's how they bounce back. You know, when Bitcoin does bounce back, when Bitcoin's down, they all fall apart. And they fall apart to different degrees. But when Bitcoin comes back, how well they bounce back is really important to us in the liquid side of our house. And, you know, a lot of that just has to do with narratives and it has to do with other stuff as well. But like, do you spend a lot of time thinking about that or you just like Solana and you want to own some
stuff? No, I like our job as Maelstrom. And as I've said, we're storytellers. That's what we do when projects contract us to help them advise. We help them tell a story. We think about where a narrative fits into the map in terms of the cycle, what we think is going to be profitable for investors, us being one of them. And so that's what we do. That's what we think about. We're not technicians.
So you said that you also like are consultants to projects. Is that what you said?
We are a founding advisor of Athena, for example, right? So we talk to them. We have other engagements as well. So I talk to founders all the time. They tell me what problems they have. I give them you know, my opinion and advice. It's up to them to take it or leave it. I write about things that we've invested and advised on from a narrative perspective. Like, okay, I think that if you tell me what you have done, now obviously we can't create success, that the success is created by the team themselves. We help amplify it and create a story around it. And so a lot of projects are bad at telling stories. They have great things that they're doing. They just don't know how to tell the story so that, you know, the average retail crypto trader understands why they like it or they don't. And so we try to help them frame those things. And that's a big part of what we do as a fund.
What percentage of projects that come to you do you just say no to because you can't get behind it?
I have no idea because I have a guy, Akshat, of Idea is he's the dude, and I just send him shit, and I don't even like people are like, oh Arthur, what do you think? I don't know. I speak to Akshat, half, you know, probably 90% of the messages that I send him, he doesn't even respond to me. So, and then when I chat, when we, you know, catch up every fortnight, he's like, okay, these are the projects I'm interested in. Here's where I want to deploy capital, blah blah blah. So I would say that, you know, it's in the single digit percent of things that he receives that he probably even that he speaks to me about.
Okay. So it has to be something you want to invest your own capital in, plus you're getting paid to do this always.
Yeah. Right? And it's again, it's an ego thing, right? Like I like Athena, obviously because they made a lot of money on it, on paper at least, but also because it's successful. It's a lightning rod for controversy for people who don't like it and like it. And hopefully I think that I'm right. It will be over time. And the yardstick is how much money I made.
Yes. Actually, how big is Athena now as of today?
I think it's like, what, 2.2 billion TVL, certainly supply of USDE. Oh, yeah. And then the market cap's FTV is what, like, I don't know, 10 million, 11 million, whatever it is.
Yeah, but TVL, I think, is what I'm most interested in watching. I mean, obviously, market cap.
Yeah, I think TVL is basically correlated to the price of Bitcoin, because as it goes up, then the basis goes up, then people want to use, put that trade on. And Athena is a very easy way to do it. And they have a tokenized receipt of it, and they can take it around DeFi and do whatever they like to do.
What else do you like? Right there.
I love Pendle. Yeah.
We know about Pendle quite a bit because of the EtherFi connection, which I know you also like EtherFi, right? Yeah.
Yes, I'm a rear-end investment advisor in EtherFi as well. So I love interest rates because I think that we've gone from spot trading. So when I got into Bitcoin, it was just spot and a little bit of derivatives. I helped obviously build the derivatives market and made a lot of money doing that.
Yes.
Just, you know, leverage trading of FX pairs. The real market is interest rates. And from like a, you know, big picture thing, like if we want crypto to be farm to table and have a circular economy, we have to have people be able to borrow and lend and fund their businesses and fund their purchases natively in crypto. And that only happens when we start to have sort of a, you know, a risk-free rate or very liquid markets where you can borrow and lend natively in these tokens and doing it in a DeFi manner. Pendle is doing that. Their creation of yield and principal tokens.
Yeah,
how they're allowing people to speculate on the yield that points will yield, or what other incentives these projects are giving has been quite revolutionary. Obviously, their TVL, I think they're top 10 in terms of TVL of a DeFi project. I think they're supremely undervalued because people don't understand how powerful and how much volume goes through the traditional interest rate spot derivatives, fixed income markets, right? The most liquid contract in the world is not the S&P 500 mini. It is the Eurodollar contract on CME. And so if we think about interest rates, this is the next market for us. We've kickstarted it with the ETH proof of stake merge. Yeah. So now the second largest cryptocurrency is a natively yielding endogenous yield, this ETH yield coming from our use of the ecosystem, which is better than like a yield coming from outside linked to some other variable. And so now we can take this yield. We have obviously liquid restaking tokens. We have all these different things that are predicated on the ETH proof of stake merge. And so interest rate trading is a natural thing to occur after that. Yeah. Pendle, I believe, is the leader in that space and their importance to the overall ecosystem. It could be the most important trading project ever in crypto, surpassing Uniswap and everything else, once we fully realize how important it is to be able to trade interest rates. And we do curve trading, all different things that you do in the TradFi space can happen in a DeFi manner, however that is. I don't know what it'll look like, but I think Pendle and their team are very switched on into how to bring that sort of trading into a DeFi narrative, DeFi native way.
Yeah.
And thus their TVL, trading volumes, trading fees, all that sort of stuff is going to go up and to the right for very, very many years.
You also invested in EtherFi.
Yes.
And what else? What else recently have you invested in that you could talk about?
DEXs. There's too many DEXs out there, but we think that we found a very, very good team, the team at Drift. So they're right now the top perp DEX on Solana, but I ultimately don't think that's the best way to think about them. They have an innovative way of how they do their automated market making system plus the central limit order book and how they merge those two together. And so right now, they might not be sort of top of mind in terms of average daily trading volume on sort of a perp DEX perspective. Obviously, the crown for that is taken by DYDX, but on a fee revenue to the protocol basis, I believe they're about top three. So in the same league of as GMX and DYDX in terms of fees that accrue to the protocol. So that's going TGE later this week, I think on Thursday. And so I like the team. I think that they are very coachable, and they, you know, from someone who's built an exchange and seeing some of the things that projects aren't doing, I think that they are very keen to take the mantle and have the chops to do it. They've been doing this since, you know, 2021 in terms of building the protocol. And now it's just starting to get some traction. So I'd say that's probably something that's very top of mind, obviously, because it's going, you know, TGE very soon. And another one would be Elixir. And so this is a team that's building essentially decentralized liquidity for to start with central limit order book perp DEXs. And so right now they power about, I think, 40% or 50% of the liquidity, the order book liquidity on Vertex, RabbitX, and another DEX, and soon to be DYDX version 3 or 4, they'll be powering that. So they essentially act as a middleware, and anyone with some stables or crypto can stake with them and then programmatically provide liquidity and earn some of the liquidity incentive returns that the trading protocols are offering in a way to enhance the yield over and above the trading fees that they receive from being passive on the order book. So I think that's a project to watch out for, because essentially you can, instead of taking a bet on the entire perp DEX ecosystem, like picking one who's going to be successful, well, if every major protocol uses them as 30 to 40 or 50% of their order book liquidity, then they're as valuable as a sum of all projects that they are powering. And so we really like that project. They should be going, their tokens should be launching sometime in early June.
The thing, I mean, exchanges, financial products, do you ever look at like gaming?
Gaming is hard. It's hard because someone's got to like the game, and that enough people liking the game, and sort of versus like, if my liquidity is X and my spread is Y, I can fairly predict who's going to be a better exchange. You could, you could hate CZ for all into eternity, but the motherfucker's going to jail for 4 months and he's still going to be making billions of dollars every day because his exchanges are like most liquid and the cheapest price.
Wait, so you can't take that CZ, away from him. I don't hate CZ,
but I'm saying a lot of people might hate on him. But at the end of the day, they have to trade on Binance because it's the most liquid and the cheapest. So a game, if I don't like Call of Duty, then I don't play Call of Duty. I don't care how many billions of dollars they spent, how many AAA engineers that they have. And so how do I determine likability as a bunch of Muppets sitting at a VC fund or a family office? I have no fucking idea. I don't even fucking play games. So how am I going to discern what is going to be the next... No.
You don't spend any time playing video games.
No.
And you never really did? Or did you have that phase?
I played a bit as a kid, but I play a lot of tennis. I hit felt balls in a court and run around like a dog. So I go skiing. I do other things, but I don't play games. And even if you did play games, I still think it's very difficult to say, okay, this game is going to be a top performer, and I can delineate, I can discern that just by meeting the team and reading their pitch deck on the game they want to build. Even like EA Sports and Blizzard can't do that. So why the fuck would you think you're going to be able to do that as a bunch of VC
family-level
Muppets? That's just how I think about it. It's just hard. It's hard. It's not, obviously, if you hit it right, it's, you know, make a fuck ton of money, but risk-adjusted, it's hard.
It is, but if you do the picks and shovels approach, like we invested in a company called Immutable a few years ago, and it's done quite well. Immutable is a platform that the games are being built on. And so as long as some games are successful, Immutable will end up being successful. And so we got lucky with that. We have also invested in some games where we're placing bets for different reasons on there, but we're not gaming experts at all. But it's a lot more fun to me than a lot of this other stuff. If it's not your thing, it's not your thing. You seem to be pretty good at what you do. Look, entrepreneur advice. I mean, Arthur, you know so much about the TradFi world. Something, I came from technology in Silicon Valley, so I knew nothing about this, and I'm learning, but I'm way behind, and that's fine. I like learning. But you also are an entrepreneur. You started a company, invented a new product, a perpetual future, and that company became very successful. And so, you know, I always like to hear your advice for people who want to start companies and like what that takes and the sacrifices you have to make. Maybe putting off a family, ignoring your family. The fact that if it doesn't go well, you may end up with a lot less money than you would have if you just kept a job, that kind of stuff. Like, do you ever talk about that? I haven't heard you give much advice on that kind
of thing. Yeah, I guess on the sort of the starting a company advice, right? It's it's how much pain are you willing to take before you get successful? Now, some people are lucky in that the product market fit happens immediately. They get validation from, you know, venture capital funds and capital. And so they don't have to suffer that much. But if you think about them in the most successful companies, the founders suffered big time, whether that was, you know, neglecting their family, whether, you know, being broke on their friend's couch. In my perspective, luckily I got fired from my job. I didn't really have any other attachments, so I could be broke. It wasn't a big deal. But for a lot of people, that's not the case. Like, they need to succeed. Otherwise, kids don't eat. Right. So it's a different sort of situation. And then how long can they deal with that stress before they get successful? And so enter into it knowing, like, how much pain are you willing to take? How much sacrifice? And if you come to the realization, not very much, probably not the thing for you. Because
was there a lot of pain, Max, or did you hit success pretty quickly? I don't know about, like, I know Bhavik joined in 2000 and like early 2018 or something like that.
For the first, call it 24 months, we barely made any money, which I guess in sort of relative terms is not that bad in terms of
you need to turn it off. Period. What did you turn the exchange on?
November 24th, 2014.
Okay.
We didn't really start doing real volume until October of 2015, and probably by winter, spring of 2016, we were making enough money to pay ourselves a decent, you know, wage to live and eat without running down our savings. So thankfully, it's because we launched a product that the customer paid for. So a lot of people in startups launch products that the customer doesn't pay for. Therefore, the VC company has to pay for it. And then it becomes a lot more difficult because you essentially traded working for the man in some sort of corporate environment to working for tech bros.
Yeah.
And so make your choice wisely. So thankfully we got into a business where the customer pays for leverage. The customer pays to trade on an exchange, and we were able to earn money. So I would advise people, try to start a company where the customer is expected to pay for the product. Otherwise, it's going to be a very arduous task to convince a bunch of usually men why they should give you money. And depending on your background and what you look like, that might be easy. It might be hard. And so assess that before you get into that.
Did you raise capital for BitMEX? You never did, right?
Very, very little.
Yeah. Yeah.
The three of us control the company. It's our company. Yeah. We do what the fuck we want. So that's nice. Obviously, that's not usually the case for most startups. And then I think the other thing, the biggest piece of advice I give is spend a lot of time on hiring well. That's probably the number one thing you can do as a founder or group of founders is spend the time to interview properly, to know what you want in terms of a job, write it down, discuss it, align on it, and then find the qualities in your candidate that match the job description, and don't take shortcuts because you need somebody in the seat yesterday. You will always regret it.
Always. Hire slowly, fire fast. I don't know who first said that, but it's great advice. So the fire fast is really good advice too. Like, get rid of bad people quickly because they're cancers.
Yeah.
Do you think you'll start another company, or do you think the Athena model is more your future, where you have ideas, other people execute on them?
I love the team at Maelstrom. It's a very small team. We have Akshat, who runs investments. Maybe have one or two other analysts. Might hire a trader, and that's it. I like it small. I ran
it's just your capital, though, right? It's not.
It's just my money. We have no LPs. We don't answer anyone about me. I don't have to worry about company politics. I don't have other co-founders. Not to say that they're bad people, but I do whatever the fuck I want to do when I want to do it. If I want to go on vacation for 6 months, then everyone else goes on vacation. I'll still pay them, but fuck, I don't care. So that's kind of how we operate at Maelstrom. It's a very small company. We do what we do. We don't do a lot of other things, and I like that.
Yeah. So it's sort of like, you have so much fucking money now, you really can't start another company because you don't have that hunger anymore. Right.
No, and I don't want to suffer. And even if you have the money, you still suffer, right? You have to spend time with people. You have to be, you know, an emotional support thing for all of your employees. And that's not a monetary thing. Like,
it's
like, some days, like, why did I open up my door? I literally have gotten nothing done because everyone had to come by and give me their problems about whatever it is. And I had to listen.
But thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. And it's good to talk to you again.
You too, man.